Welcome to another episode of the Mind Duck Books podcast. My name is Philip, and today we're discussing the sci-fi classic 2001 Space Odyssey by Arthur C. Clarke. And joining me is the expert on hard sci-fi. Welcome back, Adam.
Hello.
I'm very happy you finally agreed to talk about this book. I've been wanting to read this for a really long time. When did you first read this book?
A month ago.
Okay, yeah, so same as
it me. It was one of the books on my list of like classic sci-fi that I must read at some point. So yeah, I did see the movie many years ago, but yeah, picked up the book fairly recently.
I'm very lucky that you are one of those guys who like to delve back into the history of sci-fi classics and tries to actually go through them. And
they had a very different feel from the modern books. Mm-hmm. The modern books don't really explore the sci-fi ideas that much, I think.
Yeah, that's true. So before we get into it, just quickly to catch up, because it's been a while since you joined us on the podcast. Have you been suffering and have you been smothered by the plague that has been killing our podcast recently? Do you know what I'm talking about?
So is it Sanderson?
Yes.
I guess so, because I've been reading his, what is it called, Skyward series, I think?
Yeah.
I guess so.
You've been also hit. You've been struck by the smooth plague that is Brandon Sanderson. But this one is a sci-fi book, it's not fantasy.
It's essentially kind of the young adult novel in sci-fi setting.
I asked both Paolo and Martin if there were aliens, and you all said there are aliens, so I'm intrigued.
Yeah, there are quite a few aliens, but I think you have to get a few books deep to get to them.
Mm-hmm. So might be coming up on one of the future episodes. I don't want to promise it, but I am interested. Is there anything else you've been doing recently?
I mean, I'm continuing with the He Who Fights with Monsters new book released there. So I'm enjoying that.
So how is that going? Do you still like it?
Yeah, I still really like it. It's really interesting. It's hard to like describe it without spoiling anything, since the kind of direction the story takes is kind of unexpected and large scale, but it's really fun. I enjoy the kind of Australian, because the main character is half Australian, half Japanese, and he has kind of the Australian humor. So he kind of comments snarkily on everything, and it's good.
I'm glad it still holds up, because it's been thousands of pages since you started.
Yeah, I think I'm on book 10 now.
Oh my god. And is it the series where each book is 1,000 plus or something?
No. That was the Wandering Inn, I think.
Yeah, sorry. I confused
that. No, I stopped that one. But this one is a lot shorter. I'm not sure how long each book is in pages, but it's about 15 to 20 hours long, which I would say it's 300 to 400 pages.
Okay, that's manageable. That's manageable.
I think, yeah, something about that.
Right, so thanks again for joining me on this hard sci-fi classic adventure.
Happy to be here.
Let's get into the 1968 sci-fi classic. It's only 300 pages, and it came out 3 years after Dune. You always have to reference Dune. And of course, Arthur C. Clarke is one of the most famous sci-fi writers. We have talked about him a lot on our episode 40, where we discussed You and Me, The Rendezvous with Rama. So maybe a quick question. Did you enjoy this one better than Rama, or is it about the same?
Huh. That's an interesting question. I guess I enjoyed it a little bit more.
Me too. That's what I meant to say. No stairs.
It has its issues. This one actually has kind of characters, so that was nice.
Kind
something
of
to carry the story forward a bit.
My note says no characters again, lol, so I don't sure.
I mean, it has more characters than Rama. Like, the main character are not stairs. So that's just, like, progress.
Okay. There's a robot, like an AI that's a character, more of a character than the people. But yeah. Is there a woman in this whole book, by the way? I was thinking about that. I can't think of one.
Ah. Was it? No. I'm not sure. I kind of want to say that there was one on the moon.
Maybe.
Maybe the director of the moon operation, but I'm not sure, honestly.
I remember in the movie there are many waitresses in nice dresses in zero G serving women like that. But I don't remember women in the story doing something, but yeah. Yeah, I have to say I enjoyed it much more than I expected. I was a little bit worried going into this. This is actually one of the reasons I never read it, because I watched the movie when I was really young and it went completely over my head. I remember somebody was running on the ceiling. I was like, that's cool. And then stuff happened. And I was like, I don't get any of this. Then I watched it again much later and I really liked it. But it was kind of, I guess, pretentious is the word. To me, it felt pretentious. It felt like it's trying to show the most realistic, state-of-the-art filmography, whatever, like sci-fi that's approved by all the respectable scientists, and trying to portray sci-fi in the most realistic manner. So I was kind of worried that it's going to be super dry and it's not going to go anywhere and nothing's going to happen much, and it's just going to end in like something super ambiguous. And I feel like it did go somewhere and it had something to say, and it was much more fun than I expected. So I liked it.
I'm not sure about the ending there, but yeah.
I really appreciate something we talked about with the Rama discussion, that I think Arthur C. Clarke is very, very good at making you imagine things and making you think about stuff.
Yeah, definitely. He describes the thing in just enough detail for you to be able to imagine it without like dumping pages upon pages of descriptions on you.
That exactly.
It's really good.
I really like that about it, because there are many parts where things happen and they are not directly implying anything, but they suggest enough for you to wonder about all kinds of stuff. That's probably not even intended, but it's just very, very good at making you wonder about the universe and things and sci-fi and stuff like that. So I really appreciate it. That's why I like books. So I had a good time with it.
Yeah. Yep.
One thing that I kind of didn't like was that it felt to me as if the book was directly trying to help with the filmmaking. Like, especially after the first part, they start describing the space stations and like the moon base and all this. And there's so much technical detail that felt like, oh, look here, Stanley Kubrick, this is how this works. So film it that way. And this is how you construct it. And this is how this moves. And this is how this comes together. So did you feel like that?
No, not really. Like, other than the ending. The only issue I kind of had with it was, I felt it was really short.
Hmm.
It felt really very short, especially yes. Like the kind of the main part. I don't think it's a spoiler to say that there is a conflict with the AI.
One of the most famous AIs in the history of fiction, so I think it's not a spoiler.
This felt like it was one chapter and that was it. I was like, can I get more of that?
Yeah, that was probably my favorite part, like this.
It was very good, but it felt extremely short.
It was extremely short, and it was much longer than the movie, and it still felt like there was a lot of depth to it, and it made me think about a lot of stuff.
Well, was it really longer than... I did not rewatch the movie, and it's been ages since I've seen it. I kind of felt like the movie was a lot longer.
I don't remember it that clearly either, but I think there's long parts of the movie where nothing is said. Like in the book, there is a dialogue with the computer, and there is a lot of back and forth in between the scientist and the computer. In the movie, I think it's just like menacing silence most of the time, and the computer just saying something very bland and just refusing to cooperate. But in the book, they actually have a conversation about it, and especially when, kind of spoiling this, but it's been almost 80 years since this came out, so I think it's okay to say a little bit. When he switches off the computer, I really like that part. That was more elaborated on in the book. In the movie, I think there's like a quick exchange and then he just shuts it down and that's it. And there isn't any, like, it actually made me feel something for the computer in the book. In the movie, I don't remember caring much other than it's a villainous, menacing, evil computer. That's all I felt like.
Yeah, I think the computer feels a little less menacing in the book.
Exactly.
It's a little bit more...
Felt more justified, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
So that part was definitely scared
for its life.
Exactly. So like I mentioned, this was written together with Stanley Kubrick, which I didn't know. They started working together on this from the very beginning. And Stanley Kubrick was looking for somebody to help him write the script. And he was suggested that he should contact Arthur C. Clarke, and they really didn't like each other. So somebody told him to write a letter to Arthur C. Clarke, who lived in Ceylon at the time. Please check out episode 40 again for the details, how he likes to fly around in a helicopter with Heinlein and such. Those fun adventures there. And apparently Stanley Kubrick thought of Arthur C. Clarke that he's just an insane person living on a tree or something in Ceylon, and he didn't want to do anything with him. And also Clarke thought about Kubrick that he's just a child making nonsensical movies and didn't want to contact each other at all. But somehow they began discussing the project, and then they both co-wrote the story together, which then Clarke elaborated on it with the book, but he said that they should be both credited as writing the book, not just Arthur C. Clarke. So that might be why it's a little bit more technical or different or more focused than the other books, I feel like, because it was very, very specifically for the movie.
Possibly why the characters feel a little bit more like characters. You kind of need that for the movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But still, I feel like no characters. But yeah,
I agree. They are not very strong characters.
So one thing I want to mention is that this is based on a short story called The Sentinel. I also didn't know before I read this or before I did some research. This came out in 1951, and it's basically the same story, but it ends very abruptly. So to sum up, they find a structure on the moon, which is the same like in the book. This time the structure is a pyramid, like an evenly sized, like if you imagine a pyramid that would fit in a sphere, like the proportions are even.
Is it just a cube? Tilt the cube.
Oh, like that. No. It was just like, if you imagine a triangle and then you make two more triangles and connect it into a 3D shape. And it's like the simplest pyramid of even size.
I see.
I'm not sure what that's called. But yeah, they found that on the moon and they couldn't do anything with it. It was protected by some kind of shield and they couldn't get inside of the shield. They couldn't make sense of it. They couldn't touch it. They couldn't do anything until they developed an atom bomb and atomic energy. And at that point, they were able to just nuke it, I guess. I didn't see the details, but they just destroyed it. They tried to like get inside of the shield. And when it exploded, they completely destroyed it. And that was what alerted some kind of advanced intelligence or aliens to come to Earth, because it's like a test. They put these things somewhere, and when somebody destroys them, they're like, oh, they can do it, so let's check it out. Let's go there and see what what these creatures can do, because they were able to get through our shields, so that's like a beacon they put in place to detect intelligence, basically. So that was the short story. Yeah, funny thing about this is that it should have been a pyramid in the movie, but because of construction problems and restraints, they couldn't build it. So they suggested that it's much easier to build a slab, like a rectangular shape. And that's why it became the monolith in the movie.
Oh, was it? I think I read that the 2001 book, it's still kind of a slab, but it's kind of not very interesting looking. And then Kubrick was like, it needs to look imposing on screen.
Mm-hmm.
So they made it like taller, narrower, and black.
That's all true. But originally it should have been the pyramid from the Sentinel story.
Oh, I see.
It also should have been transparent, but that didn't look cool enough. So they made it like matte black, which I imagined it would be some kind of a lens like effect, because at one point they go inside of it in the book and they say it's full of stars. So I imagined something like the, like warping the view around it or something. And I was reading it. They don't say that, so this is my imagination. Yeah, so would you recommend this to people?
Sure. I mean, it's short enough and it is interesting book. If you like the movie, there's little reason not to read the book, I think. Although it is very similar story, the adaptation is pretty accurate. So you are not missing much by not reading the book and just watching the movie.
I'd say there is a lot book. You probably have no idea about what that was about or what happened or why is this here. So in the book, they do kind of explain all of it, which is something I was afraid would happen. So I'm very happy about it.
It kind of explains some of the things that are not explicitly said in the movie.
So if you like sci-fi, if you like the movie, and if you're curious about what it all meant, I would 100% recommend this book. If you like books for characters, character arcs, adventure, and stuff like that, I would never recommend this, because it's again, just ideas about the universe and none of the character drama. There's no character, nothing, I feel like. The only character human-like interaction is with the AI. So we have to mention the sequels. I didn't know that there are three sequels. There's four books. Did you know there are four books?
I've heard there are four books. And since I know a few things about how sci-fi, classic sci-fi continuations look, I completely ignored them.
I see. So disappointed even before I asked. Because, like we said, I wish there was more. Because I like this a lot and it was very short. So immediately I'm like, let's read all the sequels. I think that the sequels are very consistent. It's not too long. It's just 300 pages. And the reviews are not so bad. So I would...
Are they not so bad?
Well, that's for us to find out.
What does it mean, not so bad?
I didn't read any reviews or anything, but I think people are not angry about them. Many people are angry about the Rama series sequels.
I guess that's fair, yeah. The reactions I saw to the Rama books were worse than the reactions I saw to the...
Yeah.
At least the first two Space Odyssey books. I think the fourth one isn't very popular.
Hmm.
I'm not sure. I'm not going to read them.
Oh, okay. 2001 came out in 1968, and about 15 years later, 1982 was 2010, Odyssey 2, which directly continues the story after the ending, which I'm super curious about what's gonna happen, so I have to read that one. There is, in 1987, 5 years later, came out 2061, Odyssey 3, and then finally, in 1999, 3001, The Final Odyssey, came out. And have you seen the second movie, 2010, Odyssey 2?
But there is a second movie.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not bad. It's very well rated.
Okay, it's got good actors. I have no idea.
And I haven't seen it either. And I don't want to see it. I want to read the book first. So I'm going to read the book. So I have to ask, even though I know the answer already, will you read the second book and watch the movie with me?
I will... Maybe.
I'll ask again after the discussion of this book, but yeah, I'd love to, because it's not long and I think it's got something to say. It's got good ideas, and even if it's not amazing, I think the writer tried his best, because this was the series that really made him big, and it was such a famous movie, and he really wanted to put his best ideas into the series. So I think this should be something worth our time. Yeah, I feel okay.
I don't think I will commit to all four books. But maybe it's the second one.
Okay. All right, so we would recommend it. If you want to read it, please stop listening. Come back after you've read it. So let's get into the spoilers. And I have many questions for Adam, what he thinks. Hopefully we'll get to some intense discussion about what it all means. So the story starts with a part that takes place a long time ago. I think billions of years ago, something like that. Basically, primates, like, what do they call them? Apes, I guess?
Man-apes, I think. Man-apes.
Hominids, they call them, I think.
Oh, maybe hominids, yeah.
So we follow the story of, like, a tribe, and one of the apes is called Moon Watcher, is it?
Moon Watcher.
How did you like this part?
I mean, I remember there were monkeys in the movie. Mm-hmm. I was a bit surprised it's so much expanded upon here, but I didn't feel it was too long.
I liked it a lot, actually, because in the movie it's literally like 5 seconds, right? It's just like the monolith and they bang the bones and next scene and that's it. Yeah. And it kind of means what it should mean, but not really explains anything.
Yeah, I suppose the movie isn't very explicit about what this part means, while the book explains it very clearly that this is supposed to, that the monolith is supposed to like affect the hominids. Help them develop.
So there is a scene where they find it and the apes look at it and they don't know what it is. And they're really confused. And there is like a point of view of the monolith, I guess, where it's like probing their minds and trying to find the most developed brain or something like that. And it kind of chooses the apes that are more intelligent. And it like gives them the passion and motivation and like drive to improve and make tools and become more intelligent. Because in the movie, it's more like, oh, evolution happened, and now we have tools. Done.
Yeah, I'm not sure the connection that the monolith helped them develop was actually there.
That's a question, exactly, I had for you. So one explanation is the monolith kind of like made them intelligent. And the other explanation is it was only checking if they were intelligent.
I think it was making them intelligent in some way.
Yeah, I think so too. So what happens is that Moonwatcher is slowly developing like very simplistic tools. And then there's a very dramatic scene, which I didn't expect, that a leopard attacks the tribe. And usually they just kill all the apes. The apes cannot defend themselves. But this time they have a sharp tool, and they not only defend themselves, but they attack the leopard back, and with cunning strategy and using sharp tools, they defeat the leopard with an amazing fight, and everybody's amazed, and Moonwatcher is just like full of himself. He's so egoistic at this point. He's just, I'm the best alpha male in on the planet, literally. I really like that part. It was surprisingly action-packed. I didn't expect this.
Yeah.
So that's the first part of the book, much longer, and they kind of try to get into like what does it mean to be intelligent and how the thinking process works, which I really like. It's like in the prehistoric brain, I guess, what you'd call that. That's cool. I didn't expect that. So cut to the next part, which was the least favorite for me. So we jump to 2000, I think, year 2000, and humanity is now developed, and we have a moon base and spaceships, and everybody's like super advanced. And we get into this section where they try to describe all the technology. You like this part, or what did you think?
Yeah, I thought it was okay. Bit of the kind of background, how the I don't want to say politics, but bit of context to the whole thing, I guess. And it wasn't too long either. Basically, just lands. That's ferried around, shown to the director. I'm not sure if at this point they show him the monolith.
So before they mention the monolith, they have like a kind of like a space tourism thing. He's traveling to the moon and he doesn't really know why, or he's just going there because whatever. He just goes there a lot, yeah. One character. And then they find the monolith and they find some anomaly, like an electromagnetic disturbance near a crater. And then they discover the monolith, and then it sends the signal. But before that happens, there's just a lot about like the centrifugal force and how they have artificial gravity and how the ships operate and what you have to do, where do you transit when you go to the moon and all this. Maybe I was tired, but I was very bored with this.
I didn't mind.
Okay. It was fine. But once again, it was very much focused on the technology and not at all at the characters. And I was kind of like, oh, here we go again. Like, the ape was a better character than any of these characters will ever be in the rest of the story. Like,
fair point. The character we follow here is just kind of there to be our eyes.
I think this is something that would genuinely push it to the next level and made these books much more popular and appreciated if there was a character you could root for. Because like the ape, you can kind of root for him because he's becoming more intelligent and he's fighting the leopard and all this, and it's like exciting. And then, oh, this guy is sitting on a spaceship. And who is this guy? We don't know. How does he feel? We don't know. Does he have a family? We don't know. Does he... we don't know anything about him. Like, he's just a guy. Like, he's going to the moon and that's it. So that kind of bothered me, but yeah. So they find this slab monolith thing we talked about, and as soon as sunlight hits it, so they uncover it in the crater, and as soon as sunlight hits it, it sends some super strong radio signal, and they detect it's pointing it to Jupiter, I think, which it should have been Saturn, but they couldn't make it look good
in the movie,
so they changed it to Jupiter.
I think Jupiter in the book. No, in the movie it's Jupiter because they couldn't make the Saturn rings. Mm-hmm. But in the book it's still,
yes, exactly.
It's still Saturn.
Oh, I forgot. I'm confused. Okay, one of those planets.
I think so. I'm not sure either.
You're right. It's a moon of Saturn, and the name of the moon is Lapetus, like Lapetus.
I'm not sure how to pronounce that.
I don't know either.
And I think they actually aren't told initially where they are going.
That's exactly what I meant to say and ask you, and that's my biggest gripe.
I'm not sure how it was resolved in the movie, but in the book they were supposed to go to Jupiter, but it was changed to Saturn for some reason.
Yeah, it was weird. Yeah. Yeah,
not entirely sure what the
so here
reasoning
clearly
was there.
The government wants to send a mission to the moon to see why the signal was pointed there and try to see if there is anything else like any other civilization or any other monolith or something. But the crew of the spaceship is not told what they are going to do. Which, okay, let's say they're a super devoted spaceman and they want to explore and they just do what they are told. But it's just not a simple thing. This is a mission that's going to take them months, years of their lives. Yeah. And they just go for it. And three people are in suspended animation and they're like, okay, put us to sleep, we're going. But why? We don't know. It's kind of weird, right?
Yeah.
And I was even messaging Adam when I was reading this and I was like, why are they going there? Because they didn't even say it in the book. They're just, oh, they're going on this mission. Like they cut from the moon part and describing on this space moon base, they just cut to, oh, they're on this mission. And I was like, where are we going?
What mission what is are this?
We doing? Yeah. And I guess we should supposed to feel as the crew because they also don't know where they are going. It's weird. I don't know if this would work in real life. So supposedly the plan is to play them a video and reveal it when they get there. And the reasoning is that they wouldn't freak out or something they mentioned a little bit. Like they wouldn't think about it too much. I don't know. It's weird. So who's on the spaceship? How many people?
I think there are 5 people in total. 3 in suspended animation and 2 awake.
Yep.
Plus the AI.
There's the famous HAL 9000, H-A-L.
Yeah.
Heuristically Programmed Algorithmic Computer. So this is one of the most famous like AIs in the history of sci-fi, I feel like.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
From the old like books. I don't remember any other.
But The Moon is a Harsh Mistress is nowhere near as famous as this, but that has... quite like the AI is a big part of that story. Very good book. I really like that.
Yeah. So on the spacecraft, they have a special antenna array or something that they'll use to communicate with Earth. It's called AE-35. And the way it works is it has to point specifically at Earth. And if it doesn't, they can't get the signal. And the farther they get, the more precise it has to be. And there's some special system that realigns it so they can communicate with Earth. At one point, it gets broken. So HAL, the computer, he tells them that it has to be replaced. So they get out of the spaceship and they replace it, but then they find out it wasn't faulty and that the AI suggested they should replace it even though it wasn't necessary. Is that correct?
Yeah, pretty much. It all kind of sounds... Well, at this point, I guess it doesn't sound too fishy. But yeah... I think it still works. The computer just says that it should be replaced. It's about to fail. Something like that. I'm not sure if it's at this point or later when they communicate with Earth, where they have the second computer, like copy of HAL, which doesn't have this issue. It's not reporting this issue. So
that's
kind of suspicious about it, what's going on. And yeah, then they found out that the switch or antenna they took off seems to be perfectly functional. And it's all starting to smell really fishy.
So things escalate, as you might expect. So HAL says it's correct. Like he is kind of 100,000% sure that he made the right decision because he's got this data and he told them to change it because he's sure it's correct. And then the people say, oh, we have better judgment. Like we can clearly see it's not broken. So stop arguing with us. Like you're the AI, you should follow orders. And it starts to be kind of strange, like who's in charge. Do you think this was like a thing that the whatever higher intelligence from the aliens caused? Or was it just a malfunction? Or was it just a theme of people having tools and it went too far? Like it started with the simplistic tools in prehistoric times and they made these like sharp tools and stuff, and then we made spaceships and blah blah blah, and the next step in the evolution is like, okay, we made an AI that's kind of intelligence that can replace us or can be as intelligent as we are.
The
feeling that this is too far
I got out of it was the last thing you mentioned, that we developed an intelligence that was too smart and not limited. I mean, we were no longer in full control of it.
Okay. So that's probably what they were trying to say. I was thinking, is this also like a test from the aliens to see if we can deal with this or if we can destroy ourselves with our own tools?
Like that's interesting. I did not get that out of it. I feel like that would be too much of a direct kind of involvement from the aliens. Like it's a bit too far-fetched, but maybe. I mean, they were very indirect with all the meddling, let's say, because Mm-hmm. Like, sure, the initial involvement was very direct, affecting the apes.
Mm-hmm.
But then it was essentially just pointing us from... assuming you are able to reach the moon and dig up the other artifacts from there, it was mostly just, okay, you are obviously good enough to reach the moon. Surely you are not good enough mm-hmm. to reach the Jupiter.
Yeah.
So,
and I felt like the next step was like, are you good enough to get over your ego and like not be destroyed by your own making?
Maybe.
Playing on the theme of like the light testing from like even the Sentinel short story. So like, can you get into this object and then can you find what it means? And then can you advance your tools and make it advance so that it's not so fast you can't keep up with it, like kind of soft test. So that's what I was thinking about. So yeah, they didn't say any of this, but this is what the book does well. It just makes you think about these kind of things, like how tools and humanity and stuff like that evolve. So what happens next is that the situation with Hal gets more and more out of hand, and they have to get out of the spaceship. I forgot why.
I think the radio breaks this. Either way, it's not working. Pretty sure it's just not working. And they go on another spacewalk to replace it. Not sure if with the first one, I guess it doesn't matter really. And the pod, I guess that's... that they travel in around outside of the spaceship rams the other person on board, like the other colleague. What was his name? Bowman? Was it Bowman?
That's the main character.
Oh, Bowman no, survives, so the other one. But... was it Poole? And
so there's David Bowman and Frank Poole. Yeah, so Frank Poole dies.
Yeah.
Completely crushed to death. And it's not very clear. So David thinks it's a malfunction of the pod and he tries to investigate. And he gets into a discussion with Hal, and it's very obvious that he's had something to do with it. And I think at this point, they get also disconnected from Earth, and because the array is misaligned again, because they keep losing the signal when the ship is moving, yeah. So the antenna has to be realigned, but now it's stuck, so they completely lost the signal. So he gets into this like thought process how he could reconnect, and he can align it manually, but he would have to do it every now and then to keep in contact. And Hal is not cooperating, and he's trying to ask him to explain what happened with the pod. And Hal is being very ambiguous, and he's trying to like reassure David that everything's under control, and he's like the super intelligence here, and he can take care of everything. So it's much, much fishier and fishier by the second.
Yeah.
And what happens next?
Yeah, Bowman decides that he needs to wake up rest of the crew to kind of decide what to do next, because alone it's kind of troublesome either way.
Mm-hmm.
But in the process of waking them up, the ship starts losing pressure. I think at this point, Bowman kind of realizes that Hal is doing something he shouldn't. I'm not sure if he first closes the leak or if he shuts down Hal.
So he kind of decides that he has this argument with Hal. Yeah. And Hal becomes the most passive-aggressive lying bastard in the universe. Because first he is like, oh, yes, David. But David, I know better. You shouldn't do that. And then he's like, yeah, but do this, please. And Hal's like, yes, David, I will do it. But are you 100% sure? And you're not rational now. You're very emotional. So you shouldn't make decisions like that. And I should. And he's like, so Hal, if you don't do it, I'll shut you down. So you better do it. And Hal's like, of course, I'll do it. Thank you, David. And then he stops talking to him and he like opens the airlocks and airs out the whole ship and almost kills him immediately. It was one of the most famous like movie moments in sci-fi. But fortunately, David survives by locking himself into like an emergency port or something, and he puts on a spacesuit.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, unfortunately, the people who are in suspended animation are just thrown out of the ship, or they just die somehow. I'm not sure what happens exactly.
I think they die because the ship is loses pressure and air, and they are being woken up at that time. So
basically, Hal killed them.
Yeah.
So at this point, David ignores Hal and tries to get to the core. So he gets with the spacesuit back to the spaceship. And he tries to get into the core and like unpack all the security protocols and measures to get to the core of the computer. And Hal keeps talking to him about different things, which is very amusing. He's trying to like sway him from doing anything and talk about all kinds of stuff. And then David has to confirm, like, I think there's like 5 doors he has to unlock or something to super confirm that he can get to the core of the AI that's controlling the ship. And then he starts disconnecting it, and something that wasn't in the movie, I don't think, but is really well written in the book, is that he disconnects like part of the intelligence, and it kind of like changes how Hal talks and how he can reason and how he can talk until
that was nice.
He degrades.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, that was really cool. So you can kind of see like the layers of reasoning and what it takes for a mind to function correctly until Hal degrades into like a child basically and starts pleading for life because he's sure that he will get switched off, and then he switched off and David so saves himself. This was a very interesting like discussion, like one-way discussion about what it means for the computer to exist, and he's never been switched off, and if he can ever be reactivated, and would he even be the same, and all this. It was very interesting to think about.
Yeah. But it was also the part of the book I felt was, it felt very short. Like the conflict with Hal was like, okay, the antenna doesn't work. Okay, we are going to argue about it for a bit. Then the fool dies. Yes. Okay, we argue about that for a bit. And then we essentially start shutting Hal down. So, okay. That was quick. Hoping for a bit more conflict there.
It felt very movie scene like. They had to wrap it up quickly, so there's the next scene.
I guess.
There's some action. Yeah, I think it was the right length. I think if they stretched it out even longer, it could have been.
I suppose if it was a standalone book, this probably would have been stretched out a bit more, and parts of it would be cut for the movie. Since this was kind of being written for the movie, there was little reason to expand on it, I guess.
So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about like mistakes and reasoning and like wrong reasoning with AI, because I'm curious what you think. Obviously nowadays AI is a big topic, and you're an engineer. I am classified as an engineer, but I'm not really an engineer. I just pretend to be a programmer, but whatever. there is a lot going on nowadays about data analysis, data science, automation, AI, reasoning, is it alive, not alive? And something I've been thinking about, even without this book, but especially after this scene, is how do you reason with a system? And by that I mean, let's say that, like in the situation, the system's wrong, and you know it's wrong, but then the system doesn't have the data to prove it's wrong, and to give him the data that to prove he's wrong, you have to show him he's wrong, but the system doesn't know what it means to be wrong. So how do you reason with an AI that can learn on the fly and can take into consideration the consequences and circumstances that something he's decided is wrong? Like, do you know what I mean? Like, it seems to me like a unsolvable situation, because you program something or you make a system to do something, and it always takes some data into consideration and it makes a decision, right? And then once it's made this decision, that's done. There isn't a thing as to change this decision, usually. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I think so, yeah. That's difficult to say.
So this like concept of false information is very interesting to me. Like, to us as people, it's very common that we change our mind and we are constantly proven wrong, and making mistakes is a normal thing. But to like AIs and even in sci-fi or like fantasy, I don't remember anywhere to be an AI that would make a mistake and admit it made a mistake and correct itself. I don't think that's the thing that happens.
Yeah, like, that's, you know, yeah, what I mean? Okay, that's fair to say. Yeah, I don't remember that either. There should be a mechanism for it to do that. Yeah, usually they are just correct.
Exactly.
And if they are not correct, they are evil.
Exactly. That's exactly my point. So can you think of a good way to circumvent this and prevent the evilness by having the AI not just get stuck to this decision? So if you think about it very technically, I feel like it's almost impossible, because making the system question itself will make it self-feedback so hard that it will never make a decision.
Yeah, I suppose it's hard to imagine, because like even right now, whatever we called artificial intelligence is essentially a black box. we kind of can affect it from the outside by giving it different information, but we can't really change the way it thinks directly. So it's not like you could override a specific decision, I think. Or maybe you could, but still it would be like a direct change to the program, I guess.
It's a very interesting philosophical conundrum for me personally, because let's say you are an AI and you are basing your decisions on some information. The information given is from the person telling you otherwise. You know, the same person gave you the information to make the decision from, and the same person is telling you that it's not correct. So there is no way for you as an entity to believe this or that. And it's kind of like the same guy gave you this, but he's saying it's not true. So what am I to believe now? This is impossible. So, and then it kind of falls apart.
I think usually the logic is that the computer shouldn't have an authority over the human decision. It should advise, but it shouldn't have control, which was the problem here, since HAL had the full control over the ship.
Yeah, and then you get into the problem, like, maybe the people are emotionally somehow impaired, they can't make decisions, and they should, the computer should be able to save them from themselves if they are making clearly wrong decisions and being suicidal and stuff like that.
I'm not sure if it should necessarily be able to do that. It's just kind of necessary evil to not give the AI that much power over humans. I think we wouldn't accept giving that much power to the computers. We would rather accept that there is a chance of human failure.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, because I was thinking in this book, like, let's say HAL had some data that suggested the antenna was malfunctioning. Clearly to him, that's clear that this is what he did, and he did say that, and everything was explained, and suddenly the people are telling him, okay, it's wrong, and he can clearly see it's not wrong, and there's like this conflict. So what can you do in this moment to make the AI not become evil or like reason in a different way?
I think the AI shouldn't, like, it should be able to advise, but it really, like, if you tell it this is just not correct, it should just shut up and take it.
It should just take it, okay. It should just be obedient.
But actually, speaking of this specific thing, it's not, I don't think it's at any point well described what actually was the cause for the failure, like why HAL actually reported the initial issue with the antenna. And from something I read later, like explanation of the book, it said that he started malfunctioning because he was feeling bad about not telling the crew purpose of the mission.
Yeah, that was suggested. Yeah, that was a clever idea.
Which is not something I remember from the book. I did not get this feeling from the book.
I think they mentioned it, yes. There was like a bunch of existential, because it was also at the point where it disconnected from the other computer, and it was suggested a little bit, or at least I thought of it that way, that HAL is kind of like the first time, like, you know, in a feedback loop on its own and not communicating with anything, and it like overdid it because computers think so much faster and it's like ages for him without any feedback. And the other computer who was at the same speed was kind of keeping him in check, is what I thought was this suggested.
I guess that makes sense. That it makes sense that it would start freaking out kind of after it was disconnected, but like the initial issue came while they were still connected,
I understood it as in mistakes happen even to this kind of system, and it can be a very unimportant mistake.
Yeah.
A very, very small mistake. It's very unimportant, absolutely can be dismissed, but it can start something like this, and then the next escalating point was they disconnected, and then it just escalates. Yeah, so definitely my favorite part of this book, this part was very well put.
Definitely.
And I really appreciate it wasn't dragged out. I think I'm almost happier it's so short than it was too long.
Yeah, I guess. It's always a question whether the author would be able to stretch it out further with keeping the same quality.
That's true. In the name of preventing another stairs situation, I think it's good this way.
Yeah, I suppose. In context of that,
All right. So after David overcomes this problem, he finds the video where they tell him about the mission, and he learns that he should go to the to this moon and investigate if there is another monolith or something, another signal, or there is another civilization and stuff like that. So he finally gets there. There's like a stretch where he has to basically be alone without any communication, but not much happens, I don't think. Just kind of wonders about stuff, ponders about the universe. And then he arrives to the moon and he finds a giant monolith that looks exactly the same like the one on the moon near Earth.
Except it's huge.
And he sees stars in it. He says it's full of stars.
Yeah.
So that's what I meant by like the wormhole. I imagined like the warping yeah. of the space like inside of it.
I could kind of see like I was imagining in a way that it's kind of reflecting the stars of the universe okay. around him. Essentially could kind of like becoming part of the, like you almost can't see it because it's reflecting all the other stars and kind of melts oh, yeah. with the rest of the
scene. I was thinking
scenery.
Of the scene in Interstellar, how they go in the wormhole.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
How it warps around it. So I was thinking something like that, but like inside of the monolith. Oh yeah, one more thing I meant to say, speaking of Interstellar, one of my favorite quotes or like ideas from Interstellar is that they ask in the movie if there is going to be anything dangerous or evil or like horrible in space. Like they keep talking about how they're worried if they find something bad, like in a different planet. And somebody says that it's always only people who can bring evil with themselves to a different place. And I was reminded of that with this HAL scene, like people are always worried about being attacked or something horrible, menacing, evil, but it's always like people made that. That's the evil thing. So I, yeah. So they go, he goes into the monolith. I think he flies in with the ship, or does he walk
he flies in with the little pod, I think.
Okay.
Not with the entire ship, he just takes the little transport pod and flies in with that.
So this is where all the weird stuff goes down. So when he flies into it, he keeps flying through like all kinds of stuff. He sees so much stuff. I'm not even sure if I'm correct that he sees alien spaceships and like planets.
Yeah, he says like he sees other worlds, other stars, all sorts of things.
And he somehow sees like some kind of wreckage of an ancient civilization and like a binary star system and all this stuff. So much stuff. He just sees everything. And then he finally arrives to a place and it looks like a hotel suite, like a normal Earth-like hotel suite. This is the famous scene in the movie. I think in the movie it looks more like a hospital or some kind of like, I guess it's a hotel.
I don't remember this very well from the movie, unfortunately. Yeah, this is kind of where the book lost me, so what the fuck is going on?
I think it's kind of clever, better in the movie to understand, because he sits down at a table and he watches some television and he opens a fridge and everything is a little bit off. And he drinks some beer, I think, and it like tastes like something very strange, but it looks like beer. And he eats something and it looks kind of like the food he knows, but it tastes completely different. And the materials are completely wrong and the texture is a little bit weird. And the TV channel is playing stuff that was on television years ago when he was leaving Earth or something. And he kind of comes to the conclusion that the people who made, or the aliens or whoever intelligence that made this, when the monolith on the Earth's moon was activated, they somehow took the media from that time and made a place that's as similar as possible to us people that would make us comfortable when we arrived somewhere.
Mm.
So they made like everything they could know about Earth, they just put in like a room so people would have something familiar when they arrived there. But they weren't perfect about it, which I like. So everything's kind of fake and wrong, and it's not at all what it should be. But it's serving its purpose to have some comfort in a place that's completely alien. So I like it. I like the explanation.
To me, this is just kind of out of nowhere, too abstract. I don't really understand how it ties to the rest of the story. It just kind of happens. Like, okay.
I feel like it ties together because whatever intelligence alien thing, they were like, so in my understanding, I think they were like looking for intelligence in space.
Yeah.
And they wanted to find another intelligent species or just any kind of form of intelligence. And as soon as this thing activates, it's like, oh, they say something. Let's hope that these beings will manage to get to us. And if they do, they can prove themselves to be intelligent enough to get in contact with us. So let's us now prepare this like journey for them and like guide them in. And this is like the final moment. So David finds all this stuff and he is overwhelmed, completely out of his mind. And he just falls asleep because there's a bed. And when he wakes up, even more weird stuff goes down. I'm not sure what happens first. Do you remember?
I think he starts reverting back in time, something like that.
Oh, immediately. Okay, yeah, I thought so. I wasn't sure if he's like walking around. Because in the movie, he sees himself, like a copy of himself. But in here, he, as soon as he wakes up, he's already like going back in time or something. Is that correct?
I think so. I'm not sure.
In the movie, he sees like versions of himself. Like first, he sees himself at a table being like younger or something. Then he sees himself older, dying in a bed. And then cut, and there's a space baby. Everybody's like, what the hell happened? So here he falls asleep and he wakes up. He can see his life going backwards from all this ship, the mission, Earth, how he was born, what he did, until he becomes a child. Like a fetus, and then some kind of rectangular something super space thing appears in front of him and he keeps gazing into it. And to me, this was another version of the monolith, like for the apes, but this time it's for like the next level of intelligence. So it's trying to like give him more, give him like another impulse to become more intelligent.
And make him ascend to higher level of existence.
Exactly. So the same step from being primitive apes to be able to make tools and go to space and all this. So now we are in space and the same jump in intelligence to transcend like time and matter is what's happening now. So they like reversed him into a fetus and he will kind of like restart his life, but as an ascended being that's much more intelligent. And that will like push the evolution of this intelligent being to the next level again. But first they had to make him go through all this ape and spaceship and all this journey. That's how I understood it.
Makes sense. I like the story about AI a lot better than I like the story about evolution.
Yeah.
Sure.
So then what happens is even more bonkers. So he just becomes like super aware and intelligent and he can now like morph stars and warp through space or some shit. I don't even know how to describe it. So he is able to just go places and he can see that the matter itself, like the plastic and metal materials from the spaceship, it doesn't matter at all. And his clothes don't matter at all. So the clothes catch fire at some moment and disappear, I think. It's really funny.
I'm not sure if it's in the book or in the movie. But yeah, I think the clothes at some point catch fire.
I think it was hilarious. Yeah, because it's after he realized that he's so intelligent now. So F clothes, I don't need those.
I don't need that
I'm a flying space fetus. And where else would he go than to Earth, right? So he can go anywhere he wants in space. Somehow he can do that now. So he just travels back and he looks at humanity and he sees there is a nuke in the orbit for some reason. Did you understand why the nuke was there?
No, it's just there is just a nuke for some reason.
Like, is the nuke ready to be fired from a satellite? Or is it just already being fired at something? Or is it just, like, space trash? What is happening?
That's a good question. I don't remember if it was being fired or not.
I don't think they say. They just say, like, there is a nuke and...
I don't think so. I think it was sitting in a satellite, but I'm honestly not sure.
So he thinks to himself very poetically, I like my sky clear without atomic weaponry, right? And he explodes it and disappears. So he just like destroys the nuke and then the book ends with something like, oh, he can do anything now, so we wonder what he will do. So my understanding was this is the next step, like with these tools, right? Because
I guess they gave him the tools to teach the rest of humanity how to ascend. But of course there are also tools that could destroy it, so that's cool.
Thanks, bye.
Yes, okay, bye. That's the book.
Yep. I like this a lot, actually, because it's just suggesting things and makes you wonder about things, and it makes sense if you follow the like tools evolution intelligence evolution of intelligence kind of storyline, which ties in with the theme of the AI. Like, we made all these tools, and then we made tools that are intelligent and blah 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 blah, and then we did this and that, and now we are giving this like another step forward, and this guy who now can know all this has the power to just have civilization, humanity advance so much faster and become so much more intelligent, which the other alien race wants. So they want to like have the other civilization extend
it makes
as
sense.
Much as possible.
To me, I mean, I think we've already established this. I'm not a huge fan of like very abstract concepts. I like my concepts a little bit more concrete. I think the rendezvous with Rama was pretty concrete in its concepts and how it presented them. I really like the part of this book like talks about the AI and all that, but this is getting into very abstract concept, and I'm like, okay, I'm out. Yeah, that's just like, could we be a little bit more specific? Like, not just pose a huge question and close the book.
I like it. I think this is the point of the book. The point of this book is to pose a lot of questions, and it was trying to ask the biggest question at the end of it, and it tried to do something like about how people think about these things.
I guess. It's an interesting question. But I like the questions about AI more.
Me too. That was definitely the best part of the book for me too. Ultimately, I think this is what books should be. They should not only tell a story, but they should ask. They should make you think. That's what it does.
So it'd be like good if it posed the big questions at other time than the last page. Maybe explore the question a little bit. But I guess it does kind of talk about the question in a way that it starts with the monkeys, and the entire middle of the book is talking about this. I guess, but it's very abstract.
Yeah, I was sure you were going to be disgruntled about this, but
that's pretty accurate. Disgruntled. I don't hate it. I'm a little disgruntled about it.
Yeah, I was sure you were going to be that. I meant to say they were consulting different scientists at the time when they were writing the story, and one of those were Carl Sagan. Specifically him, with him, he said, they asked him, what should the alien race be, or what should this other outworldly intelligence be? And he told them that it would be a falsehood to depict them in any way that resembles humanity. And that's why they didn't have any aliens or anything that resembles of any kind of creature in the movie, even though they wanted to and they planned it in the first place. But that's why this is so abstract, because they were trying to portray something that's so different that we can't understand it. So that's the point, I guess.
I think that was a good decision, though. It makes the story a lot more timeless.
Yeah, and that's why I always thought it's a very pretentious story, because I've always felt about this story and the movie that it thinks of itself as the be-all end-all, like most clever sci-fi thing ever made. But I don't think it's that. It's just too famous for its own good almost nowadays.
Yeah, kind of. But it really didn't need aliens, and it like we didn't really need to see actual aliens. I think it works sufficiently well without them. I'm pretty happy with a big metal slap.
Big metal slap. I'm very sorry I skipped over this, but I completely shoved into your face my explanation and understanding of the ending. But I meant to ask what you took out of it. Is there any other explanation you had?
No, honestly, I was just confused.
Okay.
As I said, I don't do well with these abstract things, and I frankly probably missed half of it. So no, I was like, okay, I don't understand what's trying to tell me, and just okay, moving on.
I was thinking, somebody was asking me, I live in Japan, and somebody was asking about Czech holidays, and they were like, yeah, so you don't have Santa Claus, but you do have Christmas. So what is Santa Claus? And I was like, oh, he's just a space child that gives presents. It's like in the end of 2000 Space Odyssey.
That's certainly one way to put it.
Because in the Czech Republic we have the little Jesus. That's an abstract concept that somehow gives presents somewhere, right?
Yeah, but
that's
yeah,
not
much.
The parents that give it. Like what happened? I never understood actually. I never talked about this with my parents, I guess. What happened? Like I can understand there is like baby Jesus gets born and he's like, you know, there. But then where do presents come from? Like what happened?
Good children get presents. Why not? Who else would be giving him out?
So it is the space child David Bowman. And he's watching the good children from space. And when the children are good, he materializes presents.
Oh yes, after all, he is the higher being now, so he's omnipresent and all-knowing.
Exactly. So what he's actually has done is that he will not touch humanity at all. He will just try to like influence them step by step. And one of the first things he does is he becomes literal Santa Claus.
Gives presents to good children to motivate them to evolve to better beings.
Exactly.
Genius.
And the aliens are watching this and they're like, lol, look at him. Let's watch this.
Yeah. I like this too.
So I'm curious what they do with the next book, so please read it with me.
Okay.
We'll see. Sometime in the future. But I guess that's it. Thanks a lot. I had a great time reading it, and I didn't think it became worse talking about it, even though the last bit is a bit weird.
Yeah, no, it was... honestly, I feel a bit better about the book now that we talked about it.
Okay. That's a sign of a good book, so yeah. We recommend it. All right, so thanks again, and see you on the next
episode. Thanks for having me. See you next time.
Bye.
Bye.